Right, we're up and running. Okie doke, so thank you for that. I'll confirm next week whether there's a class on the 16th, but there will definitely be one on the 23rd. So, what we want to cover tonight is gravitational lensing, how Hubble has contributed to putting firmly into the astronomer's armoury a method that really goes all the way back to Einstein himself, but I guess Einstein never figured that it would be possible in practical terms to actually use it as a tool for studying the sky. Is that too dark for people, or is that all right? Okay, that's good, because some of the images are quite dark. They'll look better on the screen. And I think if I've estimated correctly how long this will take, then it will lead into beginning a discussion of cosmology, and that really will take us right through to the end. And that's mainly why I wanted to tag on the extra class, because I don't think we can get through it all in just another 2 weeks. But as I say, that depends partly on whether my student's available, but hopefully he will be on the 16th, and I will certainly be able to wrap things up on the 23rd. So before we start on that, because, you know, we're going to sort of largely leave the topic of the planets and so on behind that we covered last week, has anyone got any questions that they'd like to ask to begin with?
Can I just ask a question? If we don't presently have the wherewithal or technology to identify Earth-like planets, and that was very clear, then why are we searching at this point in time?
That's a good question. I suppose we are, but to bear in mind, we actually kind of do have the technology. I mean, I was emphasising that we hadn't got it in any of the planets that had been discovered yet. But remember, the Kepler probe launches on the 5th of March, so only 3 more days, and it is designed specifically to look for Earth-like planets. Now, it may not find any, but the Kepler probe has really only been possible in the strength of the expertise that's been developed over the last 13 years. So although from the outset it was never expected initially that we'd be able to find Earth-like planets, what it allowed astronomers to do was to develop technology and to develop techniques and to develop search methods that hopefully in the end would make that possible. And indeed, you know, I remember as I wasn't a student by then, I guess I was a sort of researcher down in Sussex University, hearing a talk in the mid-90s, when the first planets were discovered, and, you know, people were saying, oh, it might take us decades to find an Earth-like planet. And indeed, it still might, but we're kind of on the threshold of it now, and it's because of all the effort that's gone in, you know, and I think without that, it probably would have taken even longer, you know. So,
is that the prime aim, then, of
Well, it's a good question. I mean, it is certainly the prime aim of Kepler, but should it be the prime aim of searching for exoplanets? To be honest, I think that's driven as much by the opportunities for funding, because, you know, it sells well to government agencies and to politicians and indeed to the public if you can say we're trying to find planets like Earth. I mean, it would be, of course, incredibly profound if we did find life on another planet like our own, but, I mean, I think, in a way, that slightly undervalues the scientific achievement of finding all the planets we have found already, because, after all, you know, that in itself is still telling us something quite important about other stars, that they've got planets around them, even if we haven't found one like the Earth yet.
The reason I raise this just now is I'd imagine worldwide the funding of research is bound to be severely hampered now because of and imagine a lot of the motivation then will be political.
Well, to some extent that's true, but to be honest, I mean, I don't want to say everything in the garden's rosy. I mean, budgets are tight, but to be honest, the amount of money spent in astronomy is not that much, not compared with, you know, one has to say, the, you know, defence, and indeed even other areas of science like biotech. You know, and I'm not saying that, you know, as if, oh, you know, poor us, we wish we had more money. I mean, obviously every field wishes they had more money. But, you know, given... it's a tough one to answer. You may well be right. I mean, you know, we're all sort of prepared for tough times ahead, but it's as much because of other factors, things like, you know, interest rates being so low and so on. I mean, like, for example, we have scholarships within the university for funding postgrads, and those funds are seriously depleted because, you know, the investments haven't been returning as much as they would have done in the past. But the actual amount of money that, well, like, say, the Obama budget, there's a lot of money being put into renewable energy, and in those terms, maybe astronomy is going to be a bit further down the pecking order. People are looking for more practical spin-offs than you know, esoteric things like finding life on other planets. But, you know, things aren't so bad. Maybe one of the things that helps is that many of the projects are so long term that the budgets are set well in advance, and therefore it will take a while before changes in the, you know, economics catch up. And of course, you know, who knows, maybe things will be looking a bit brighter in a few years' time. Could go the other way as well. But many, you know, certainly all the missions that I've talked about that either are already happening or are planned for the next few years look fairly secure. Now, there isn't anything that's, you know, going to be cancelled, but that may change. But say at the moment, you know, Kepler, it's full steam ahead, for example, in just a few weeks' time. Ah, I've not read it yet. Okay, well, that's good. So there you go. I'll maybe put a link to that in the webpage, because sometimes some of the articles are available even if you haven't bought the magazine. But that's good to know. Okay. Any other questions? I see there's an excellent point that the changing face of funding might well make a lot of what I've said look rather different in a few years. But I say I don't see any immediate cause for alarm.
If there were another civilization on another planet.
Yeah.
Would we have any chance of observing it from the radio waves?
Yes, that's something that I wasn't planning to cover too much because, you know, the course's remit was mainly to talk about Hubble. But we have some degree of involvement in Glasgow in the Square Kilometre Array project, which I'm hoping in week 10 I'll say just a little about, because that's a project which, well, it's down to a choice of two for where it's going to be located, either South Africa or Western Australia. And it's going to be the world's biggest radio telescope for the next 15, 20 years. There's absolutely no proposals for anything bigger in the next few decades. So it's going to be, you know, the biggest game in town in radio astronomy. And our involvement in it is to do with the design. And I'm one of the investigators, although I really, you know, cannot emphasise enough, I'm just a tiny cog in a very big wheel. There's hundreds of people around the world involved in this. But what I've found especially interesting is seeing how the science case for the Square Kilometre Array has been assembled. And it goes back to what I was saying to you as well, that we recognise that if you're going to build a science case that politicians are going to take any interest in, it never hurts to put in a few things about searching for extraterrestrial intelligence. And I heard a very interesting talk at one of the SKA Square Kilometre Array meetings in Manchester, where the person talking about the SETI work, Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence with SKA, was frankly admitting that, you know, we're not really expecting to detect anything, but it's exactly the sort of thing that the politicians, you know, sit up and pay attention to.
Our civilization gives off radio waves for communication.
Yeah.
And with the great alternating current transmission lines.
Yeah. Now that I think is the main point I was just going to add about SKA. Unlike the searches in SETI up until now, which have been very closely targeted and effectively have been just looking for a message that the other civilization might be sending. I mean, we've no idea whether such a message would be remotely intelligible. Would they even use radio? You know, these are all very good questions. But if they did, and they happened to send a message our way, then the Arecibo dish in Puerto Rico, for example, ought to be able to pick something up within a few tens of light years. What's crucially different about SKA, because its sensitivity is so greater, then it should be able to detect not intentionally sent messages, but just the natural leakage of radio and television, if they have television, just like we produce, and send it into space whether we like it or not. I mean, many of you, I'm sure, will have seen the movie Contact.
To pick up communication radio waves or the radio waves that leak off the power line?
A good question. I suppose it really just depends what frequency band you're looking in. I mean, the frequencies that SKA will be targeting are around the 21 centimetre line in neutral hydrogen, and that is envisaged as the sort of frequency that an alien civilization might want to use, because it's associated with water. It's associated with hydrogen, the most abundant element in the universe. It's also very relevant to astrophysical things. You know, I mean, if you hear 21 centimetre signals and it's Morse code, you know it's from an alien civilization. But you can pick up useful information at that frequency, at that wavelength, from any galaxy as well. So it's, you know, you're not just, in other words, if you listen to the universe in 21 centimetres, you might get lucky and get a message from E.T., but you're going to learn a lot of good science anyhow. So that is the sort of frequency that one might want to look at. Basically, if you're looking for, you know, radiation that's leaking out from power lines, then I think it's going to be much much longer wavelength,
yeah,
and consequently is more challenging because there's more of a background. There are, however, plans, these are very early stages, but plans to try to put an extremely long wavelength radio antenna on the dark side of the moon, and that might be capable of picking up that kind of leakage. Yeah. So these are all, you know, all projects that ultimately may well be affected by credit crunches and so on, you know, because these are vastly more ambitious. Maybe to partly retract what I said earlier, the SKA is perhaps the one big project, because it's so vast, it's like multi-billion dollar, that could be seriously affected by the credit crunch. But most of the, like, you know, Kepler's a relative snippet, just a few hundred million, you know, and I know that might sound like a lot, but when you compare it with the cost of defence, for example.
That's Fred's pension.
Yeah, indeed. Absolutely. We should ask him for a contribution. Yeah.
Is there any difference between... You may be coming on to this, I'm sorry.
Not at all.
Between stellar or galaxy lensing and dark matter lensing?
Certainly, there is indeed. I'm going to exactly come on to that, so if you don't mind, can I maybe just defer that for a wee bit? The short answer is yes. The slightly longer answer is yes, they're called respectively strong lensing and weak lensing. And the details we'll get in a wee minute. Okay, so that's an excellent question. Right, shall we move on to a wee bit of lensing then? See, we'll keep the questions coming, but I suppose we'd better try and make a bit of progress with the details. This is just another wee look at an image that we showed last time, which is a rather beautiful one. It's the Einstein Cross. This is a Hubble image that was taken of a little group of images, all of the same distant object called a quasar. More on quasars in the final few sessions, possibly starting tonight, but more likely next week. And it's very far away, as is revealed by this number, which we call Z, known as the redshift, and again, more details on that to follow. But the bigger Z is, the further away it is. And at a redshift of 1.7, well, you're talking, oh, about 10 billion light years away. So that's very far, and the light's been travelling to us for billions of years. But on the way, it's passed through, and this is one of the reasons I wanted to switch the lights off. Perhaps you can make out this sort of ghostly image of a galaxy in the foreground. So that galaxy is much, much closer to us. The redshift's only 0.04, that's, you know, relatively in our backyard. But it's bending the light from the background quasar and bending it so much that it's producing these multiple images. So I flashed up that image last week, but it was mainly talking about lensing in the context of seeing planets round stars in their own galaxy. Now we're going to look at how lensing can let us see things which are much, much further away. Remote galaxies, remote quasars even, things if kind of, you might say, at the edge of the universe. So what's it all about? Well, it's fundamentally got to do with Einstein's general theory of relativity, which is a topic that we devoted a considerable amount of time to in the day's class that I ran last year. And I think I mentioned this at an earlier point in the course, that all of that material is still there. And if anyone wants to go and download the presentations, if you're sort of fired up to find out a bit more about relativity, then you're most welcome to do so. And I'll put a direct link to it on the Hubble Vision page, just to cross-link across to the other course. You know, there's a few people that were on the course last year. So Einstein published his general theory of relativity in 1916, and there's the front page. Now, my German's not up to it, but I can at least read the front bit, which is on the foundations of a general theory of relativity by Albert Einstein. And after that, well, ironically enough, I can't read the German, but at least I can unfollow the math. I suppose for many people it's the other way around. It is a very challenging theory. It's a very complicated mathematical theory, but the idea, the central idea of general relativity, is not that wild. It tests our understanding of the everyday things around us. We think of space and time as absolute things, whereas relativity, both its special and general forms, tell us that we shouldn't be trusting that anymore, that space and time are relative. But nonetheless, the basic principles of general relativity can be stated fairly succinctly, and that's the main thing I want to do in the first part of tonight, to give you a flavour of what relativity is all about, what general relativity is all about. So, as I say, the maths is challenging. You can see that if you look at this image, which is taken from the National Academy of Sciences in Washington. I was there a few years ago. It's a beautiful sculpture of Einstein, I think. It really captures the sort of cragginess of his face, the classic image of Einstein, the old wizened professor. But of course, if we look at the previous one, he was quite a young man when he developed all this. So, you know, I'm already way past it in terms of my productivity compared with Einstein, who was doing all of this in his 20s and 30s. The three equations that you see in Einstein's notebook here, well, there's E equals mc squared. Everyone's heard of that. The middle one is to do with what we call the photoelectric effect, and that's the thing that Einstein actually got the Nobel Prize for. He didn't get it for relativity at all. It was all to do with how light comes in little packets of energy called photons and is capable of knocking electrons out of atoms. And I thought that was worth just a passing mention, because that's actually the principle by which the detectors on board the Hubble telescope work. The digital cameras, like the advanced camera system we've been showing all these beautiful images for, the way it works is by exploiting the physics, which Einstein developed a theoretical appreciation of in that middle equation and got his Nobel Prize for. But it's the top one that's general relativity. And even the symbols look a bit stranger. It's kind of a bit hard to see the detail. But what you see there are Einstein's field equations, which relate the curvature of space and time to the matter and energy in space and time. So, it's a challenging theory. I love this cartoon by Sam Harris. He does loads of great science cartoons. This one just kind of sums it up. It's got a very challenging reputation, general relativity, but we're going to really simplify things tonight, because, first of all, we don't have time to do it in detail, but secondly, I think you can get the key concepts without any of the maths. And indeed, that was Einstein's own view, that one could describe the theory without too much detail. He gave a public lecture on relativity when he came to receive an honorary degree. I think, if I remember rightly, this was in the late 1940s, after the war had ended. And as I understand it, he was, you know, well, he was accepting invites all over the world to give lectures and to receive honorary degrees. And he gave a talk up in the Butte Hall, and by all accounts, I've got a transcript of it actually. I might, I'll need to check the copyright, but if it's okay to do so, I'll put it on the webpage. And people, well, yeah, but I hadn't actually checked, and then I was told afterwards that maybe shouldn't have, so I'm not sure whether that was strictly correct, but again, you know, I'm just being a wee bit more cautious this time. If truth be told, I didn't take it down from last year's, because it is password protected anyway, and I thought, well, you folks aren't going to go and sell it to the papers. But the Einstein sort of published works and everything, is there's very strict there's very strict copyright rules about the use of the Einstein name, and indeed even the image. So I'm perhaps playing slightly fast and loose with that. But, you know, it's in the spirit of the fact that I'm not trying to make any money from it. I'm just trying to promote the idea that he was a wonderful scientist. So his public talk in Glasgow went down well. As I say, it was challenging to get all this difficult stuff across, but he was up to try to do it. So I'm, you know, trying to do the same all these years later. And essentially, you can sum it up in one neat phrase, which is attributed not to Einstein himself, but to John Wheeler, an American astrophysicist who worked on black holes, lived to a very ripe old age, and really is a, for a long time, was a link to Einstein's own generation, because, you know, he'd met many of these people like Einstein and Schwarzschild. You've maybe heard of Schwarzschild radius of a black hole, all these people that were around in the early 20th century. So Wheeler came up with this phrase: space-time tells matter how to move, and matter tells space-time how to curve. And the usual picture that we come up with to describe this is to think of a stretched sheet of rubber into which you drop a heavy weight, so maybe like a trampoline, into which you would drop a cannonball, it will cause the sheet of the trampoline to deform, to bend, and it means, therefore, that we can think of the effect of gravity as the bending of space-time. So, most if not all of you might well remember Newton's laws of motion, and one of which says that if a body isn't acted on by a force, it'll just keep going in a straight line. Now, we don't really think of that in our everyday life so much because, you know, if you take your foot off the accelerator, the car stops. But that's because of the friction. And anybody that's driven in an icy road will know that actually Newton's law pretty much gets it right. That if there's no friction, then the car will just keep going in a straight line unless you apply a braking force. So how does that tie in with gravity and relativity? Well, essentially, the curvature of space-time just replaces the straight lines of Newton's first law with curves. So a body acting under gravity will kind of behave as if there isn't any force acting on it, because gravity, in Einstein's view, isn't really a force at all, it's just a curving of space and time. And this very neatly sidestepped a real problem which Newton's view of gravity had, which was, well, Newton gives us a formula that tells us how to work out the force of gravity, but it doesn't tell us how the gravity actually gets from the sun to the earth, or the earth to the moon, or from the earth to the apple as it falls on Newton's head. It's not as if the moon is held to the earth by a big piece of string that pulls it round. So how does the moon actually know it's supposed to orbit the earth? Well, according to GR, general relativity, the moon is just following the natural local contours of the curved space-time. In that sense, the moon doesn't even really have to know that the earth is there. All it has to do is feel the local curvature and keep moving in the closest thing it can do to a straight line, which happens in the case of curved space-time, to be like the circles you see on the stretched rubber sheet. Now, as I say, that's only scratching the surface. There's all sorts of beautiful detail that comes out when you look at it in more detail, but that, I think, is the main idea, is that gravity isn't a force anymore, it's just a property of the geometry of space and time. And that means that gravity ought to affect light as well. See, according to Newton, well, actually, ironically, Newton didn't know that light had no mass. He thought that light perhaps was a little stream of particles, like, you know, billiard balls, and therefore, perhaps in Newton's view of gravity, it was quite natural to think that gravity could bend light as well. But we later discovered, and indeed Einstein himself played a part in this, with that middle equation, that light consists of little photons, little particles, that actually are massless. So if Newton's view of gravity was right, then light should be completely unaffected by the gravitational force, because the gravitational force depends on how massive the body is. If it's got no mass, it feels no Newtonian gravitational force. But Einstein replaces that idea with just the curvature of space-time. And photons are going to follow a curved path, like a billiard ball rolling round the cannonball, just the same as a planet would, or just the same as the moon would. So, does it actually happen? Well, we think it does, and we call it gravitational lensing. So, in about 1919 or so, maybe 1918, Einstein wrote a paper on this. There were numerous papers shortly afterwards, but basically everybody sort of thought, including Einstein, that it would be too small an effect to ever measure, because the amount of deflection of the light would be very, very small indeed. How would you make the light be more deflected? By making the space-time more curved. How are you going to do that? By having a more massive and denser body curving the space-time. If I drop a cannonball into this, it bends a lot more than if I drop a football. So that's the idea. But it wasn't envisaged back then that we could ever have a massive enough body to produce the amount of curvature needed to really bend light by a lot. But, as I think I briefly touched on last week, there was still the expectation that you could measure the very, very small bending of light as light passed by the sun during a solar eclipse. And off went Arthur Eddington to observe that in 1919. So there was already observational evidence that gravitational lensing happened, but it was a tiny effect, and it wasn't ever expected in Einstein's time that you'd be able to ever see multiple images and things like the Einstein cross that we saw at the beginning. So, the multiple images, to now this sort of echoes back to Tony's question, is what you would term strong gravitational lensing. It means that you can easily see the distortion of background objects, maybe even multiple copies of them, as the light comes to us along different paths. So Einstein knew about that as a theoretical possibility, but didn't seriously expect that we'd ever be able to see it. Weak gravitational lensing, well, there the distortions would be much less, and this is relevant, again, to something that Einstein himself didn't know about, but we now think the universe is pervaded by a sort of smooth distribution, at least around galaxies, of dark matter. We don't really know what it is yet, but we think it's there. And that will have an effect on the curvature, but only a very small effect because it's not so concentrated. Again, if you drop a cannonball into here, you get a big bending. But if you drop, what's a good example? A suitcase that weighs the same but is much bigger, then the bending of the sheet will be less localized. It will be more spread out. So in any given place, the bending won't be quite so severe. So the weak effect of gravitational lensing can be due to a lot of matter, but because it's not concentrated in one place, it's less dramatic. Therefore, as we'll see, it's quite a challenge to observe. And really, the first one and the third one are kind of the same. Gravitational microlensing that we talked about last week really is strong gravitational lensing. It produces multiple images, but the images are so close together that you don't see them as separated. All you see is the effect of the light in the combined image making the background object appear brighter. And that was how we saw last week. You could perhaps detect some planets. So these are three regimes. Now that we've kind of left the planet scale behind and we're looking instead at much bigger scales, then it's mainly going to be the first and the second that we'll discuss, although I'll say a little about the third as well. Okay? So, strong gravitational lensing. So I want to, wherever I can, not get too bogged down in the details, but just concentrate on what we actually see, because some of the images are really stunning, but they also tell us a lot. So we can see things like arcs and rings, multiple images. Some of the most famous Hubble images are in this area of science. And we'll get on to some of the images that were seen. Underline the word ring, and indeed this is a kind of special thing here. It's called the Einstein ring. If you've got the lens, the observer, and the lens source exactly aligned with each other, then Einstein showed in the 30s, building on earlier work by Chvolson, and then very soon thereafter followed by Fritz Vicky, that we ought to be able to, let me choose my words carefully here. Einstein didn't say this. Einstein said that one could get this Einstein ring, but he did not say that we ought to be able to observe it. What is an Einstein ring? Let me see that first, then I'll come back and say more about Zwicky. So an Einstein ring, just to show you a picture of what I was discussing there, here's us, there's the thing that's doing the lensing, and there's the star or galaxy or whatever it is that's being lensed. So the point is, because they're all exactly lined up with each other, then the light from the star, let's suppose it goes off in that direction, it will then get deflected by the matter, the lensing matter, and it will come off in this direction. So it will look to us as if the light actually came from up there. But because of the symmetry of the thing, that will apply all the way around the ring. You'll have light beams coming off the background source being deflected by the matter. Of course, the deflection angles are hugely exaggerated here, just so you can see what's going on, but the principle's the same. You'd expect to see this ring. So Einstein demonstrated by just working through the equations that this was possible. Fritz Zwicky was the first person to seriously argue that you might be able to observe this. And this is because he thought about it not just in terms of a star being lensed, but actually a whole galaxy being lensed by even maybe a cluster of galaxies. And Zwicky, as some of you might know, was famous for another reason, because he'd advocated, based on his studies of the movements of galaxies in clusters, that there was dark matter out there. So just it's a slightly convoluted story, but you know, it's important to put the pieces together. Zwicky's argument went like this. He said that the galaxies and clusters were moving too fast to be explained just by the gravity of the light alone. You know, the galaxies were full of stars. You could estimate how many stars by how bright the galaxies were. You could roughly weigh them then. If they were all stars like the Sun, you know how much the Sun weighs. You could work out what the mass of the galaxy cluster was. The galaxies were moving too fast to be compatible with the amount of mass that appeared to be in the form of luminous material. So Zwicky was really the first person to put forward the idea that maybe there was other material in between the galaxies. He wasn't saying what it was, he was just saying that it had the effect of making the galaxies move faster. In a way, you know, we're kind of used to that idea with gravity, because if I drop this rubber and pen, the Earth's mass doesn't care. It pulls both of them towards the ground at the same rate of acceleration, regardless of what they're made of. So the motion of the things as they fall doesn't tell you what they're made of. Just like the motion of the galaxies in a cluster didn't tell Fritz Zwicky what the dark matter was made of. The motion of these things as they fall, if you measure the acceleration downwards, tells you something about the mass of the Earth. Because if the Earth was more massive, they would fall faster. If the Earth was less massive, they would fall more slowly. So Zwicky, by studying the motions of galaxies, could say something about how much dark matter there was, but he had no idea what it was, and we still don't really know what it is. But he said, well, if you've got dark matter, then that can affect gravitational lensing as well. So he was the first person to argue that not only, as Einstein had said, was this a theoretical possibility, but it might be possible to observe it. Because you could look much further away and you could have much larger amounts of matter doing the lensing, and therefore you might be able to see it as a measurable effect. Now, I can't resist adding, as many of you might have heard before, a slight postscript about Zwicky, if you'll forgive my language, which is to say that not everyone took him seriously because he really wasn't very popular. He had this reputation for being really irascible. He hated all his graduate students, for example. You know, I tell mine about Zwicky and think, you know, you think I'm bad, you know, you could have had him. And he really hated all his colleagues as well, and he used to describe them all as spherical bastards, because no matter which way you looked at them, they were still bastards, was what he said. So to say, excuse the language, but to say it's an indication of, as maybe the picture also suggests, that he was quite a character, and consequently his ideas often were not taken all that seriously, not really because there was anything wrong with the science, but just because people didn't like him very much. But he turned out, we think, to be right, both about dark matter, although annoyingly we still don't really know what it is, but we certainly think there's good evidence that there's dark matter in clusters, and indeed his ideas about lensing were very possibly well ahead of their time and shown later to be right. So, I digress. So there's the Einstein ring in theory. Here's the Einstein rings in practice. These are Hubble images of distant galaxies. Some of them are quasars, even, which is really just a type of galaxy, but a very distant one that is especially bright. And these are images showing excuse me, how the light has been distorted as it's been lensed, as it's passed by intervening matter in the form of maybe a big galaxy or possibly even a cluster. Actually, all of these are sufficiently small scale that it's really just intervening galaxies that are doing the lensing. But some of them are really striking, and you can see in some cases they're almost perfect circles, indicating that us, the lens, and the source of light behind are almost perfectly aligned. And if they were just a tiny wee bit out of alignment, you wouldn't see the ring to nearly the same extent. But these are among my favourite images of all the images produced by the Hubble Space Telescope, because I think the way that they link back to ideas that predate even Hubble himself, ideas that go right to the heart of Einstein and relativity, and which he never imagined would ever be testable, and yet Hubble helps us to do it.
Well, the conditions for that, they're very stable, or you don't find that the one chance
No, that's an excellent question. Again, it really just depends how far away the object is. If you were looking at something really far away, then over our lifetimes, the alignment is not going to change. Because even if they're moving with respect to each other, you know, after all, the background object doesn't know about the one in the foreground, so they could be moving, you know, at slightly different directions, different speeds. But over our lifetimes, the amount of angle in the sky that that corresponds to is absolutely tiny. But there are examples of gravitational lenses within our own galaxy where we see the motion. Indeed, the microlensing effect that I talked about last week, we wouldn't know that the lensing was happening unless the alignment was changing. Because if something is brightened, but it just stays brightened all the time, you'd never know it was brightened because you don't know what it looked like when it wasn't being lensed. And that's actually a challenge with these systems, because if you want to know how much matter there is doing the lensing, it helps a great deal if you know how bright the source was before it was lensed. But of course we don't get the chance to see that. You can't just switch it off. Okay? So it's an excellent question. I think I'll come back to just an aspect of that in a few minutes. So anyway, what's going on? Again, just a picture, hopefully not too technical, but just to let you see roughly what's going on. So you've got your lens, and just for sort of relative simplicity, I'm keeping the lens in the same position. And the background source, you know, I've just drawn it as a wee circle, it could be a quasar, a galaxy, whatever, it's moving. So each one of these circles corresponds to a different position of the source. And as you can see, the images aren't perfectly aligned here, so we don't get an Einstein ring. What we get instead is just two images, one on one side of the source and one on the other. So basically, every time you get a new circle position, then you get two new images, and, you know, distorted in shape. So one can sort of look at this as a little movie. Okay, so what we talked about last week, the microlensing, is where you don't see those images because they're too small. But what you see instead is that the combined brightness of the images changes. So over time, the star, if it's a star in the background, gets brighter and then it gets dimmer. But what we believe is actually happening is that the images of the star that are produced by the lens are changing in position, changing in size, changing in shape. And that's what produces the curve over here. So when you're looking at microlensing, all you get to see is the curve on the right. When you're looking at lensing on bigger scales, like the Einstein ring images, then you actually see the distorted pattern of light. But as we've just been saying, the price you might pay is that you never see it changing. So it makes it harder to work out what's going on. Whereas in this case, you see it changing a lot, even just over a few weeks. So strong lensing is all about having multiple images of background objects, either galaxies, in which case they're separated by substantial fractions of a degree, or at least enough you can measure. If it's microlensing, then they're separated by too small an angle to measure, but you can still tell they're there because of changes in brightness. So Hubble has seen lots of examples of strong lensing. Indeed, we've already seen the image with the Einstein rings. But among the more famous Hubble images, in addition to the Einstein ring ones, is where you're looking at a background galaxy with a foreground cluster of galaxies. And here's one. This is quite an early one, 1995, before the advanced camera went up. So it's the wide-field planetary camera. But what you're seeing here is a cluster of galaxies, and all of these strangely distorted little arcs of light are images of background galaxies that are being focused and distorted by the matter in the foreground cluster. Almost a bit like what would happen if you took a glass lens over an image and distorted it. So, go ahead, no. What you're looking at here would be, I guess, about, on the sky, would be a few seconds of arc. So that's about a thousandth of the width of the full moon. And the distance along the line of sight, the galaxy cluster's probably a few, I'd need to check for this exact one, but if it's Abel 2218, that was named after a chap called George Abel, who compiled a galaxy cluster catalogue in the 50s. So it's probably not that far away. It would be a few hundred million light years away. I know that sounds probably not that far away. It's obviously a huge distance compared with even the stars we've been talking about. But in cosmological terms, it's the light's only been coming towards us for a few hundred million years. So it's relatively recent that the image left the object. Some of the more distant objects, the light's been travelling for billions of years, so you're effectively looking further back in time. But not so much with this image.
I'm assuming the space between the galaxies is the order of, after the Andromeda galaxy, 2.5.
Yeah, absolutely. Not far off that mark. I mean, it's a cluster, so they're a bit more densely packed. Now, that's actually an interesting point. Again, I'll briefly digress, but it's something we'll come back to in subsequent weeks. We live in a spiral galaxy. It's a good job we don't live in a cluster, because spirals don't last in clusters. They get torn apart. And, you know, you might say, well, it's a kind of selection effect, like anthropic principle type stuff. You know, we have to live in a spiral, because if we didn't, we wouldn't be here. It's not, you know, terribly profound observation, but it is worth noting that the galaxies are much more densely packed in a rich cluster. And in some ways that's quite good, because everywhere you've got a galaxy, you've got a potential lens, and that means that you can probe the mass distribution better than if the galaxies are more spread out. So rich clusters are a good place to look for lensing to be happening. Here's another one. This is a massive elliptical galaxy at a redshift, well, near as damn it, 1, and it's lensing another one which is at much higher redshift. So again, we'll get into the details of this later, but the redshift is a measure of how far away the object is. The bigger the redshift, the further back in time you're looking, the further away the object is. And when you're up at redshift 4, you're looking back 12 billion years, you know, almost to the very first galaxies. And a post-starburst galaxy, that means that the galaxy has undergone a lot of star formation. And we'll see many Hubble examples of starburst galaxies next week and the week after. Now, what's important about this one is that we think that that's been lensed. So, well, let me just go through the details here carefully. So there's a foreground elliptical galaxy that's lensing a background galaxy that's much further away. And what we try to do is to model the mass of the foreground galaxy. So this little elliptical shaped oval here, all ovals are elliptical shape, that's the elliptical galaxy, and then you're getting multiple images of the background spiral distorted and magnified. So essentially the task that astronomers have is not just to make nice pictures, they certainly are nice pictures, but is to try and work out what mass is in the foreground causing the lensing of the background object. And that's often quite difficult, because you don't see the foreground mass, you just see the effect that it has. So you have to try and work out what's there from the effect it has. But astronomers have developed very powerful techniques for doing all of this. In some ways, they bear a striking similarity to software that's got much more commercial value. I was over in Dublin at the weekend, a family trip this time, so the divorce papers will not be served. We were visiting relatives, and they've just introduced a new thing on the M50, the ring road around Dublin, where you have to pay. Oh, in fact, that just reminds me, I've got to do it tonight, but no, that'll be all right. There'll be time when I get home. You've got to pay a €3 charge for using the toll motorway. But it used to be you just put coins into a little kiosk. Now there's image recognition software that images your number plate. And actually, a lot of the algorithms for doing that were originally developed in astronomy. So here you've got your fuzzy Hubble telescope, or in this case, very large telescope array image. This is sort of typical of the kind of thing you get from Hubble as well. And what you've got to try and do is clean that up to restore the distribution of light that you'd expect if it wasn't the case that you were getting a distorted image. And that's the prediction of what's really there, but we see a kind of blurry image because no telescope's perfect, not even Hubble's perfect, and especially not the VLT, because that's sitting underneath the atmosphere. Not much atmosphere because it's in Chile and it's at high altitude, but it's not as good as the Hubble. This has got 0.5 arc seconds resolution. The Hubble can usually get down to about 0.1 arc seconds resolution. So you might well be asking, why didn't I bring an example of a Hubble one? This was one I could easily lay my hands on because it was an analysis done by a former colleague of mine, and it illustrates the general point, but actually Hubble's been even better at doing this, at letting us reconstruct what did the lensing. And it's like, you know, I mentioned CSI last week, it's another example of that. It's like, you know, CSI, forensic science, trying to deduce after the fact what must have happened to produce the image that you're left with. Now, the pattern's pretty complicated. That's what produces the distorted image. We call it a caustic structure. And, well, to let you just get an insight into sort of what can happen, if you look at the patterns of light on a pond or a swimming pool, and indeed even in this case I think it's just the beach, shallow water at the beach, the sunlight brings out these very complicated patterns. You would get it in a swimming pool as well, where the light is being distorted as it's being bent and lensed by the water. So it's roughly the same. It's just that it's the mass distribution that's doing it instead of glass or water. So these would be called caustics as well. And this is from a colleague, Joachim Wambgans, an eminent German astronomer who works in lensing, and he was on sabbatical in Australia a few years ago and decided what he wanted to do was to lens the image of a kangaroo. Why not? And the point is, you can see that the image of the kangaroo gets distorted in all sorts of bizarre ways depending on where the bits of the kangaroo are in relation to the lens, and these strangely shaped patterns indicate the regions where the light will get magnified most and get distorted most. So it's a very rich area of research. See, it makes lovely pictures, but it's also quite complicated. The patterns of magnification can be complicated. You can get very sudden, rapid changes in magnification in different regions of the image, or indeed if the background source is moving, then that can be changing in time as well. But generally for these very distant images, they're too far away for us to notice them moving. So we just see a fixed pattern of brightness, and we have to try and work out where the matter is that's doing the lensing. So if we go back to Einstein Cross again, those multiple images of the Einstein Cross, they're all the same thing, just lensed by different amounts. The challenge is to work out where is the mass in that foreground galaxy that can produce those background images. Now, interestingly, this is just to bring it around full circle and back to your question about the alignment and the changes. You sometimes see micro-lensing in these. So this is the same Einstein Cross we saw before. Multiple images of the same background quasar, but sometimes the brightness of those individual images changes. So here's one from 91, there's one from 94. So that one down there has got quite a lot brighter in the space of 3 years. Now, why would that be? It's because this is a background quasar. It's an active galaxy. It's got stars in it. The foreground image is a galaxy, it's got stars in it too. So the background quasar and foreground galaxy are already quite closely aligned, but individual stars in both of them sometimes will be even more perfectly aligned. And when that happens, you'll get a short-term brightening of the background source. And the stars are moving, and because the alignment is on such a tiny scale, even over the course of 3 years, they've moved out of alignment, or in this case they've actually moved into alignment because this image is brighter. It's because some star or little group of stars in the foreground galaxy is just perfectly lined up with some stars in the background one, and it makes it seem temporarily brighter. That can help you to constrain how much matter there is overall, because you're getting a kind of an extra special look at just a tiny part of the image. So, again, the Hubble telescope's good for this sort of thing because it allows you to probe tiny scales that would ordinarily be too blurred out, be too washed out by the effects of our atmosphere. Okay, so that's a little bit about strong lensing, just a few remarks about how Hubble has been useful. I'll just say a few words about weak lensing before we stop for a short pause. Weak lensing is a much smaller effect because it's coming from matter that's much more smoothly distributed, so you don't get as big a distortion, a bigger bending in space. So what basically happens is that if you've got a whole bunch of galaxies that you're looking at, then each one of them individually will be distorted a little bit. But if you didn't know what the galaxy looked like before, it's quite hard to tell how much it's been distorted by. But how you get around that is just by looking at so many galaxies that you figure, well, on average, some of them will maybe be distorted that way, some distorted that way. But on average, we can somehow take that into account and work out what the overall effect is. So it's essentially equivalent to saying, well, let's just assume that all the galaxies are actually round. We know they're not, but some of them will be stretched out that way, some of them will be stretched out that way. Therefore, when we lens that, that will add some extra distortion over to what's already intrinsic to the shape of the galaxy, and we should be able to disentangle the two. It generally leads to quite complicated pictures like this one, but all you need to take from this one is that if you're looking right through the centre of a cluster, then you don't really see this weak lensing. What you see instead is the multiple images like we saw before. Weak lensing is more important when you're looking at the edge of a cluster where there's maybe no big galaxies to do the strong lensing for you, but there's probably enough dark matter to just slightly distort the images of background objects. So, if you've got a cluster with some big galaxies in it but lots of dark matter in between, then you can expect that it's going to produce these distorted images of the background galaxies, and hopefully that will tell you something about how much dark matter there was. Now, I'm no expert in this. I've done a bit of work in it, but mainly in relation to my main work, which is to do with distant supernovae and distant gravitational wave sources, because they'll be affected by this. And we'd like to understand the weak lensing better so that we can see how much it's affecting the light and the gravitational waves that hopefully in the future will detect from the background objects. But the main experts in Scotland, at least, are in Edinburgh. There's an army of people that work on weak lensing over there to great effect, and involved in all sorts of ground-based and space-based missions to study weak lensing. And this is an image due to Richard Massey, who at the time this was done was over in California, popular place. He's now in Edinburgh, and I was talking to him just last Wednesday. And this was Hubble data again, and the idea was to look at very distant galaxies very carefully and look at lots and lots and lots of them and try to build up a statistical picture of how they're distorted in shape and deduce from that what the distribution of dark matter was between us and the background galaxies. And this is just Richard's kind of cartoon of how that might work. There's the Hubble there, so obviously not to scale, but they're sort of building up a picture of where the dark matter is to produce the distorted images of the background galaxies. And that's very much at the cutting edge of what has been done.
So dark matter is meant to be just like the sort of transparent shell.
Yeah, obviously, you know, the old cliche, if it was truly dark in the image, you wouldn't see it, so you have to make it transparent, you know, transparent blue matter. But yes. Well, the existence of dark matter, I would really, you know, again, I'm being slightly provocative here, I think is confirmed. I know that, you know, confirmed is a relative term. I mean, you know, how do we know that electrons exist? We know that they exist because the belief that they exist helps us to explain so many other things that we observe. That's equally true of dark matter. I mean, there are alternative explanations still produced. There might, for all I know, be alternative explanations that explain how your telly works, but I think, you know, a beam of electrons is by far the most convincing. Now, telling what it's composed of, that's another matter altogether, no pun intended. It really is a much greater challenge. And again, you know, the illustration I did before when I dropped the pen in the rubber, I mean, that's quite an apt one, I think, that gravity doesn't care what the thing is made of. It's just this distortion in space-time. You can cause that distortion with any kind of substance. You know, your billiard ball could be made of, I don't know what billiard balls are made of, but, you know, could be made of any material you like. As long as it's heavy enough, it will distort the space-time the same way. So really identifying what dark matter is a big challenge. I'm going to talk about that probably next week in a bit more detail. I'll touch on it tonight if there's time after the break.
Is it imminent? Is it going to be 10 years from now?
Depends who you talk to. There's a good friend of mine from the time when I was a postdoc at Sussex, who's now on the staff at Nottingham University, and she visited last week to give us a seminar on direct dark matter detection. And you might know, and I was planning to say a bit more about this next week, is that some of that is actually done in underground observatories, and there's a deep mine in Yorkshire called Bowlby, where what you're trying to do there is to detect the effect that these dark matter particles might have on other things, like ordinary atoms or molecules, because they'll cause reactions to happen in those atoms or molecules when they bump into them. But those kind of reactions can be happening all the time when, say, you know, light from the sun or charged particles from the sun is interacting with matter. So you've got to get deep underground to try and shield yourself from all that. And therefore it's a bizarre idea that you do astrophysics a mile underground, but that's where these direct detection experiments are currently being done. There's a range of laboratories around the world where those kind of experiments are being done. I was at a meeting in Germany 2 weeks ago where we were discussing the possibility to place in the future a gravitational wave detector deep underground as well. That's for a different reason. It's to isolate it from lots of other disturbances. But again, it would be, you know, a matter of sharing the laboratory space that's being used for some of these dark matter experiments. So, to come to your question, talking to my friend last Thursday, you know, her best bet was 5 to 10 years, but, you know, that's the kind of figure everybody says, you know. And then in 5 to 10 years' time, we see another 5 to 10 years. We just don't know. And I mean, it is a puzzle that we haven't detected anything yet. It tells us that whatever dark matter is, it's very, very elusive. It's very weakly interacting. It doesn't interact with many things. And that, as I say, is a puzzle.
And presumably the person that finds this out eventually will their name go up in light in the same way that Einstein and Newton?
Well, to some extent, yes, but it won't really be an individual. It will be a collaboration of hundreds, even possibly thousands of people, because on the experimental side, that's what it takes. I mean, you know, it's such a cliche, this, but it's true that some of the scientific papers written by these collaborations, even just a list of authors, spills over onto the second page before they've even told you what they've done. Where Einstein was so very different was that he was doing this sort of theoretical work and was largely doing it on his own or with one or two other people. But the experimental work is much more of a collaborative venture. But see, more on dark matter to come. I say, I'm glad that you have asked the question, and I'm sure it's one that, you know, others will have their own thoughts on as well. I mean, Hubble really hasn't told us all that much about dark matter, with the notable exception of the next slide. And there isn't really time to do this properly before the break, so let me just sort of leave it up there, and after the break we'll talk a bit more about this. Okay, this is another example of Hubble's ongoing contribution to answering some of these big questions.
That sort of mode, is that what it's seen, or is that indicate where dark matter is?
It's not quite that simple. It's partly what's seen, but it's also indicating where you will observe hot gas, because as we'll see after the break, this image tells you what Hubble sees, or as an indication of where the luminous matter is, luminous as invisible light, but you can also combine that with emission that's visible to an X-ray telescope, Chandra it's called, and that's helped to address the issue of where the dark matter is, what it is, at least partially, although, you know, I stand by what I said before, it's very hard to know exactly what it is. Put it this way, we have a good idea of what it isn't, and I'll explain more about that after the break. Okay, so 5 to 9, will we go again then? So our clock's given up on us, but I make it 20 to 9, so about 15 minutes. And if anyone wants to come and see the meteorites in the meantime, then please do. give ourselves a bit more light again. Robert, how's it going?
Oh, not so bad, thank you. I just wanted to ask whether you'd seen the email that I sent.
I did, but not I've had a lot of not in detail.
Yeah.
I've had a lot of 18 to 20 hour days in the last few weeks just with all this travelling. I have a huge backlog because we had the launch of the International Year of Astronomy in Scotland last Wednesday. So I was talking in Edinburgh about that. I'm leading, a number of projects. It's kind of on the list, but it's a very long list.
Oh, no, that's fine. I understand that.
Yeah.
No, it's just basically, it's my sort of idea of what I might do the essay on.
Sure.
So
yeah. No, I certainly think, and I mean, I read it to the extent that is this a good idea for an essay, and it certainly is. You know, by all means, have a go. I think, in the same spirit as what I said to you last year, I think it's obviously perfectly acceptable to do the essay just as a kind of review of, received wisdom, but if you want to kind of push the boundaries a bit with your own ideas, then that's perfectly fine too, to be encouraged, in fact.
Okay.
I look forward to seeing what you come up with. But I think realistically, at least for the next 2 weeks, as I say, I'm at the stage where I come in usually, 7, 8 o'clock, and the entire day is just totally mapped out.
It was really just to make sure that it was kind of more or less an acceptable.
Oh yeah, I think so.
But having that engagement, that's enough. So
no, certainly. I think we've talking with Ali McKinnon, we've always felt that offering the credit for this course is an opportunity to let people, for want of a better way to put it, to express themselves, and I think that doesn't have to be solely in regurgitating what's been covered in the lectures. I think, actually it's rather useful if people can use the lectures as a springboard to, to explore new things. Yep, so go for it. Yep. So the next thing I wanted to discuss is some work done. Another person who's now in Edinburgh, Catherine Haymans, had been a student in Oxford, then did a PhD in Edinburgh, and when this work was done had moved to the University of British Columbia. And Megan Gray, another former Edinburgh person, as I said, it really is this engine room of UK work on gravitational lensing, moved from Edinburgh to the University of Nottingham. And this attracted a fair bit of press coverage a few years ago. This was in about 2007. And advanced camera images showing the region around not just one rich cluster of galaxies, but really an amalgam of two, which is referred to as a supercluster, Abel 901 and 902. So what you see in the little panels around the edge is a kind of zoomed in version of the cluster, or regions of the supercluster. So what does all of this tell us? Well, here's another example that was actually even more widely reported in the press, and one where it happened to be able to lay my hands on some details that would help to explain what kind of things we can learn from such clusters. Similar analyses have been done with the one that Catherine and Megan worked on, but this one, the Bullet Cluster, is an even more widely reported example. So what do we see here? Well, we can see an optical image taken with a Hubble telescope. So all the little blobs in that are galaxies. So this is the negative, just by way of contrast, it's a wee bit easier to see the red contours, and we'll explain what those are in a minute. And the galaxies are just tiny little blobs, but they're very numerous because it's a rich cluster. There's a lot of things going on. In actual fact, it's two clusters. So it's referred to as the Bullet Cluster, but it's really, we think, an indication of two clusters that are in the process of merging together. So this is very far away. It's significant redshifts, not redshift 1, so a few billion light years away. And what we're seeing there is a cluster that's kind of still in the process of forming and is actually merging with another one. So, what can we learn from it? Well, dark matter could just be gas. It could just be atoms, like we're made of, which aren't shining. After all, that would make it dark. And it could be hot gas, which isn't shining in the visible part of the spectrum, or at least not very brightly, but actually would be highly luminous if we had X-ray vision, because hot gas can radiate a lot of X-rays, and it can have a temperature of even millions of degrees. Now you might think, how on earth is it going to get so hot if it's out there in space? But this can be gas which is accelerated. Remember, if these clusters are merging, there's a very strong gravitational field, so the gas is getting churned up and disturbed a great deal by that process happening. So there's a type of radiation that goes even in British circles by its German name. We call it Bremsstrahlung. It means breaking radiation. And it's the radiation that comes about when gas is decelerated or accelerated very, very fast. So the sorts of dynamics that are likely to be going on when two clusters collide, you might think, would be capable of moving the gas around at such speeds that it would give off a lot of this radiation. And sure enough, that's exactly what you see. And because Bremsstrahlung generally gives off most of its radiation in the X-ray part of the spectrum, then you don't see it with Hubble. What you see it with instead is a satellite like the Chandra X-ray satellite. Now Chandra is one of the great observatories that NASA put up to cover not just the optical but other parts of the spectrum as well. And it was launched in 1999, it's still going strong, at least I think it is, yep. And one of its contributions here was to recover images of the Bullitt cluster to complement what you saw with Hubble. So to emphasise just what we have then, we've got all the little blobs, which are galaxies that Hubble saw, in negative form over here, and then the original image over here. And then what you see the white contours are, is where the X-ray gas was being picked up by Chandra. So the gas is glowing. So what you're really seeing is that you expect the X-ray gas to be produced when it's being sort of churned up and moved around, accelerated by the gravitational pull within the cluster, but it's going to be quite smoothly distributed. In fact, I've got much better images than that. I might as well take full advantage of the technology here. I can very quickly show you another one that maybe more readily brings this point home. So bear with me for just a moment. I'd meant to add this slide actually and just never got around to it today, distracted by too many other things. GU stuff. High energy astrophysics. Which of course is not the sort of thing that Hubble contributes very much to, but it's still a very active area of astronomy because we can learn so much from studying other parts of the spectrum than just the visible light. So this is just a little slide from some of my undergraduate lectures. But yeah, here we are. Perfect. This is what I want. So what this is images taken with not the Chandra telescope, but a very similar one called the X-ray Multiple Mirror Telescope that was launched by the Europeans. You know how we've been talking about these Abel clusters? They were observed by George Abel. This is what they look like in X-rays. So instead of seeing hundreds, even thousands of individual blobs, which are galaxies, what you see instead is just the smooth distribution of light, X-ray light, that's coming from the hot gas. The brighter the colour, or rather the redder the colour, the hotter the gas. So the hottest gas is in the centre, and then it's a bit cooler around the edges. But look how smooth the clusters are compared with all the galaxies. So, dark matter could be that. It could be hot gas. In some sense, it's not really dark then. It's just that it's not visible in optical light. It's visible in X-rays. But there's a problem with that. Now, this is something, again, that lies well beyond the scope of the course, but just let me very briefly mention what the essential idea is. In the very early universe, we've not even talked about the Big Bang yet, but we're going to talk much about it in the next few weeks. We believe that the hydrogen and the helium was basically manufactured in the first few minutes. And all those other elements, the metals, as I referred to them, that astronomers see as we look out around the universe, were not manufactured in the early universe, but were actually made inside stars. So we talked about that a few weeks ago. But the hydrogen and helium are accompanied by just tiny, tiny amounts of a few other elements, beryllium, lithium, and a heavy form of hydrogen called deuterium. So the amounts of deuterium, beryllium, lithium, and helium can be predicted from theory and then compared with what we actually observe. And this provides more evidence in support of the possible existence of dark matter, because we can predict the abundances of these elements really well, but not if the universe only contains what we see in the luminous matter of stars. So it's another piece of evidence suggesting that there's more to the universe than meets the eye, you might say. So allow me that rather poor pun. But the significant thing is that if the dark matter is in the form of just other elements like helium and lithium and so on, then it's just atoms. But even that's not enough. The dark matter that we seem to detect from looking at clusters, the suggestion strongly is that it can't be made of atoms. It has to be something more exotic, something non, the word we use is non-baryonic, not made of protons and neutrons. Now, that sounds like a pretty wild idea, but it's actually got some support in this image. You might not think so, but the point is that the white lines are hot gas. That's what Chandra detects. Now, the hot gas is just hydrogen, so that's perfectly legitimate as a baryonic dark matter candidate. It could be dark in the sense that it's not visible to the optical telescope like Hubble. It's got mass, so it's matter, but it's made of atoms, hydrogen atoms in particular. Now comes the red contours. The red contours are the distribution of matter that's been deduced by studying the pattern of background galaxies and using gravitational lensing. So basically what's going on is that we've looked at the background galaxies, which actually are really too faint to see directly here, but if you study the images very closely and close up, you can detect them. And those background galaxies, just like we saw earlier, like this one, and indeed some of the images, this is just a cartoon version, but it's got the essential idea. The distortions in the shapes of the background galaxies can be used to tell you where the matter is in the lensing cluster. So that's what's been done for the Bullitt cluster. So the red lines, a bit like a kind of an ordnance survey map, tell you where most of the matter is, just like, you know, the lines become very densely packed when you're close to the peak of a Munro. So where the lens are most densely packed is where most of the dark matter is. And the point is that the dark matter traces fairly well where the X-ray gas is, but not always. So there seems to be some dark matter in clusters even where there isn't very much X-ray gas, which is a suggestion that the dark matter, whatever it is, can't be something as simple as just hot gas that we don't see with the optical telescope. So the dark matter, reconstructed from lensing, seems to sometimes be in a different place from where Chandra tells us the hot X-ray gas is. And that's a puzzle. We still don't really know what's going on there, but it helps to reinforce the view, which was already supported by the abundances of the chemical elements in the early universe, that whatever the dark matter is, it can't simply be made out of hydrogen or other atoms. So the plot thickens, and we'll get a little bit more into this whole story of dark matter and how we think we know about it over the remaining sessions, because we're going to look at wider aspects of cosmology. But let's just wrap up the discussion of lensing, and then we'll sort of pause for breath and see if there's any questions. Here's, at least the last time I checked, one of the most distant images that Hubble had ever obtained, because what it shows is another one of these gravitationally lensing clusters, another Abel 1, 2218 this time, And that little red blob there is a background galaxy that's been lensed. In fact, it's got a multiple image. There's two images of the same galaxy. We think it's the same galaxy. It's at redshift 5.6, which is, you know, way out there, so then about 12 billion light years away.
Is that an optical image?
Yep, that's an optical image. Yep. But if you were to observe that cluster with X-rays, then what you would see is not all the galaxies, but you would see the smoothly distributed hot X-ray gas. And as I said, one of the things that can be done with lensing is you can look at the optical image and try and work out where the dark matter is. You don't see the dark matter, but you see the effect it has, and then you can compare that with where the hot gas is. Now this is, you know, it's a relatively new idea, and it's got a, you know, you might say it's important to have a good brand, so people have thought about a good name, and essentially it's really the field that I'm now working in. If I want to say, you know, what area of astronomy do you work in, I say multi-messenger astronomy, because it's all about combining data from optical, X-rays, even gravitational waves, all these different types. And it's quite a challenge, but it's a tremendous opportunity, because we can see objects in a completely different way with these different sorts of light, and it can tell us much more than just the optical images alone. So for all, the Hubble telescope has been a phenomenal success, and that's mainly what we've talked about in this series of talks. Many of the objects that Hubble's looked at, if you also look at them in radio, X-rays, gamma rays, microwave, you'll learn even more. And this would be one such example.
Is the value of Z on this photograph, or what do you want? Sorry.
No, photograph is fine. That's what it is, really.
It's a true value, because for a while, dark mass and the 4% visible energy pulls you back, and then dark energy is pushing you away. So could it be
We don't think so. I mean, it's something that you for once we actually can measure directly, and I now I'm moving into exactly the sort of territory that your question addresses, you know, to do with the dark matter, dark energy. Sorry, I mean, I'm always sort of saying that and answering your questions, you'll just wait a minute and I'll answer it more fully. But let me now, as perhaps maybe I should have done earlier tonight, to recognise that I've been dropping in this word redshift quite a few times without really saying what it's all about. So we're only going to begin that story tonight, but it will be a story that we'll continue with next week as well. What does this redshift actually mean? What the number measures is the factor by which the wavelength of light that's observed in this little blob of galaxy has been stretched compared with the same light if it was in just a lamp in the laboratory. Because galaxies are made of hydrogen, by and large. They're made of stars, which are in turn made of hydrogen. So a lot of the emission that galaxies give off corresponds to these spectral lines that we talked about earlier in the course of hydrogen. Now those have got very well-defined wavelengths, very well-defined colours, but if you're looking at an object that's moving with respect to you, the lines will be shifted. We talked about that in relation to finding planets a couple of weeks ago. Here, it's not so much that the galaxy is moving through space, it's instead that space and time itself are stretching as the universe expands. And even that concept, for all, it's been around for 80 years now, I've not mentioned it in the course yet, so that might be somewhat new to you, the idea that the universe is expanding. That's really what we're now going to focus on for the remainder of the course, is how we come to know that. At least that's our best guess at the moment, is that the universe is expanding. We have very good evidence for it, and Hubble has played its part in acquiring that evidence. So as a result, we can look at the spectrum of light from that galaxy, and we can look for spectral lines and compare their wavelength with where the same line would be if the galaxy weren't moving at all, and it's stretched by a factor of 5.6, actually 6.6, just the way it works. It's 1 plus Z is the stretching factor. Longer. 6.6 times longer than it would be. Yeah. So that actually means that some spectral lines, which are, say, in the ultraviolet, if you're looking at a galaxy that's not affected in this manner, it's not moving or it's close by, they'll be moved into the visible part of the spectrum, by the stretching. And other lines that would normally be in the visible part of the spectrum are moved into the infrared. So that has to be carefully taken into account as well. But that is a great industry. The number of galaxies that we now have redshifts for is well into the millions. And, you know, we're getting very good at this. But the data's not perfect. But essentially what we get is a handle on how much, by what factor, the lines are shifted. And that tells us what that number Z is. And the bigger Z is, the further away the galaxy is. And we're going to see exactly how that works. Well, just coming up any minute now. Okay. So, that brings us to our final topic, really, which, as some of you who've been at courses we've run over the years know only too well, often can occupy the whole 10 weeks. See, Margaret came along to a course I did, must be about 15 years ago now, Margaret, I think.
98.
No, not quite that long then. 11 years. Cosmology from quarks to quasars, we called it, and it was like 20 hours just on the theme of cosmology. And to be honest, back then, we didn't know the half of what we know now. So there's many, many unanswered questions, but we've made significant progress since 1998, at least in trying to answer a number of those questions. So if anything, it deserves more of, you know, there's more of a case for it deserving a course all to itself now. Maybe we will, that's right, an update. So, from the very outset, an apology that maybe this isn't going to do it justice, because I'm going to try and cram a lot into the next few sessions. Let me at least say that we'll try and give you a good overview of just what cosmology is all about, let you see what are many of the unanswered questions, but at the same time let you see what we actually are fairly sure about. So if I'm asked to sum up what cosmology is, I'd try my best to do it something like this. I say that it's the study of the universe as a whole, so that we're not concerned with the properties of this star or that planet or that galaxy, but just trying to get the big picture. And consequently, we have to sacrifice an awful lot of detail to get the big picture. We try to describe the universe in as simple terms as we can, and try to get a handle on how it began, how it's evolved, and perhaps even how it might behave in the future. Now, our raw materials for developing such a picture is exactly the sorts of things we've been talking about throughout this course. The images that the Hubble telescope has taken, images by many other satellites and many other telescopes across the whole electromagnetic spectrum. But one of the most famous images in the whole of cosmology is this one. This is called the Hubble Deep Field, and it was taken by the Hubble telescope in 1995 just by staring at a tiny patch of sky for a very, very long time and bringing out details of distant galaxies that we hadn't known were there before. But where did it all begin? Just to get us going in the remaining 10 or 15 minutes tonight, we're not going to talk much about the Hubble telescope, but we're going to talk about Edwin Hubble, after whom the Hubble telescope is named. And it's really a story that George Lucas has put better than I can. It's all about what happened a long time ago in a galaxy far, far away. And really, the developments since the time of Edwin Hubble have just all been about us being able to see further and further, and hence longer and longer ago. So Edwin Hubble was working in the 1920s at the Mount Wilson Observatory near to Los Angeles, in the mountains just north of the city. And he was using, at the time, the world's best telescope, which was the 100-inch, okay, the 2 inches don't really make much difference, but just to get my facts right, the 100-inch Hooker reflector, which is basically about the same size as the Hubble telescope. But not nearly so good, for obvious reasons, because A, it was not at high altitude, not in orbit around the Earth. B, close to Los Angeles, which at least wasn't quite so smog-ridden and light pollution back then as it is now. And C, of course, it didn't have all these fancy detectors that we talked about in the first 2 weeks. So Hubble was doing his work just looking through the eyepiece by eye and by taking photographic plates. None of your digital camera technology for him. But he was still able to make some amazing advances. He looked at what were called nebulae, things like this. This is the Andromeda Nebula, or the Andromeda Galaxy, because we now know that galaxies and nebulae are one and the same thing. Nebulae is the term that astronomers used to give to these gas clouds that they would see in our galaxy. Some of them are not galaxies. Some of them, as we saw earlier in the course, are clouds of gas out of which new stars form. But this one is a whole separate galaxy. Now, how do we know that? Well, it was really Hubble that helped us to answer that question. And he did it by finding Cepheid variable stars in the Great Nebula in Andromeda. These are stars, as the name suggests, which vary in brightness, named after the very first such example, which was the star Delta Cephei, the fourth brightest star in the constellation of Cepheus. Delta Cephei was identified as a variable star by John Goodrich, an astronomer that we'll see a picture of in a minute. But I just want to fill you in a little bit of the background. How do we measure distances to stars? Well, for very nearby stars, and we touched on this in an earlier class, we can use trigonometry, very solidly reliable mathematics. And the idea is essentially none other than the sort of effect you see if you hold your finger up and first of all cover your left and then your right eye, you see your finger shift in position. Or the other example we have here is the two chaps are looking at the top of the tree. It's lined up with a different mountain on the horizon. So the astronomical equivalent of that is to look at a nearby star from the Earth 6 months apart. You'll see the star shift in position with respect to more distant stars. And the shift in angle allows you to work out how far away the star is. So again, hugely exaggerated, but you see perhaps the effect. If you view the star in January, it looks as if it's over there. If you view it in July, it looks as if it's shifted over to the right. Now, even the nearest star shows a shift of only about 2/1000th the width of the full moon. So it's a really tiny effect. It wasn't measured until the middle of the 19th century. But it's now measured quite reliably for many, many stars in our local neighbourhood. But that only gets you so far. It only gets you a few hundred light years. Even the nearest star, good, I'm glad I remembered that figure correctly, 1/2000th the width of the full moon. Cepheids provide a way to measure distances much, much further out. So Goodrich, working in the 18th century, discovered that, I mean, he died when he was only 22, so he crammed a lot into a very short life, but he discovered that Delta Cephei was changing in brightness. Now, Cepheids are very luminous. They're found up near the top of our colour magnitude diagram, our Hertzsprung-Russell diagram that we talked about earlier in the course. They're found in this region. They're kind of yellow, whitish in colour. Temperature a bit hotter than the sun, but not much. What's actually going on with a Cepheid? Well, this is a cartoon of what we think a Cepheid is doing. We think that it's changing in brightness because it's actually changing in size. It's pulsating. Pulsating in and out. And the amount by which it pulsates is very closely linked to how bright it is. So if you've got a Cepheid that pulsates not very much, then that's probably because it's not such a bright Cepheid. It doesn't get so big, doesn't get so bright. And the other thing is, it doesn't take very long to go through one complete cycle of pulsation. Whereas if a star is much bigger, it will look much brighter. It will also undergo the pulsational cycle over a much longer time. Now, I haven't put any scale in this, but you're typically talking somewhere between a few weeks and a few months. So you actually don't have to wait very long to see it change. So just a cartoon picture. Basically, the picture is suggesting, or trying to suggest, that what's changing is a kind of outer envelope around the star. And the quantity that's basically changing is something that we call the opacity of the star, which is how opaque it is to the radiation coming out from the centre. So the more opaque the outer part of the star is, the more radiation gets trapped inside the centre of the star, therefore the Cepheid doesn't look so bright. But it operates like a kind of valve. That happens for so long, and then eventually the opacity will change and the star will expand again. And it's almost like a self-regulating process, so it can keep going for a very long time, going through this cycle. Now, that's what we think's going on, but how we came to that deduction was because of this person, Henrietta Leavitt, who established the existence of a relationship between the brightness of the Cepheid, its luminosity, and the period of pulsation. And that's what you see in these graphs. There's sort of two types of Cepheids, and they both show very well a kind of straight line relation. That means that the longer the period, the brighter the Cepheid. So the details of that needn't worry us. We don't want to get bogged down in graphs and things. But the key thing to think about here is, how did she know how bright they really were? Well, the plain truth is she didn't. But what she was looking at was Cepheids in a neighbouring galaxy called the Large Magellanic Cloud. And that meant that all of the Cepheids were pretty far away. And I think a good analogy here is, say I ask, you know, how far is it to, the way I normally put this with just no particular reason why it has to be London, but, you know, London train stations. How far is it to Euston? Probably say about 400 miles from Glasgow. And you say, how far is it to King's Cross? Well, 400 miles. But if you're stuck in the middle of London trying to decide which station it's easier to get to, it might be quite important whether you're a few miles closer to Euston than you are to King's Cross. But seen from a very big distance away, you might as well just say they're at the same distance. So it's the same idea with these Cepheids. She was looking at Cepheids in the Large Magellanic Cloud, which were all effectively at the same distance because they're so far away. Therefore, if one of them appeared to be brighter, it must have been because it really was brighter. So that was the key idea that allowed her to make this deduction. So the apparent brightness of all these different Cepheids, she was able to compare with how long it took them to go back to the same brightness again, their pulsational cycle. And it showed this excellent fit. She still needed, or subsequent astronomers still needed, to find out actually how far away the Large Magellanic Clouds were. And that's a series of steps involved, that each one of which is, you might say, a bit shugly, to use a local term. But nonetheless, the distance ladder that you build up in that manner was fairly reliable. But the key step that Leavitt did was to identify that this distance sample, that were all effectively at the same distance, could be used to reveal this relationship between their intrinsic brightness and their period of pulsation. That's what Hubble then subsequently used to work out how far away, in relative terms, the Great Nebula in Andromeda was. So here's, just to wrap up, final few minutes, and then we'll pick up the story with Hubble next week. The relationship is that the period of pulsation, somewhere between a few days and 100 days, so as I said, you know, less than a week up to a few months. The range in luminosity, this is all in units of the sun's luminosity. Again, if you're not familiar with the notation, don't worry about it, but 10 to the 3 is 1,000, 1 with 3 zeros. 10 to the 4 is 10,000, 1 with 4 zeros. So Cepheids are a lot brighter than the sun, but how bright they are also depends on their period. Now, the period is something you can measure, so that lets you deduce how luminous these things are, and therefore you compare that with how bright they appear to be, and you can get a handle on their distance.
So this is, she didn't care, she didn't really need to know how far they were away.
No.
Because all she's doing is doing luminosity, relative luminosity.
Some measure of luminosity, relative luminosity, exactly.
Versus the period.
And exactly.
Later on we came along and calibrated all that.
Exactly. Absolutely, no, that's exactly the case. And indeed, Hubble's original work, measuring the distance to Andromeda, essentially what he was doing was saying, well, the Andromeda Nebula is like so many hundreds of times further away than the Large Magellanic Cloud. Actually, it's not that much, it's about 50 times further away than the Large Magellanic Cloud. He still didn't know the actual distance, but he knew that it was very, very far away, and therefore it had to be big to still look as big as it did on the sky. So I'll come back to the inverse square law at the beginning of next week, and I'll come back to my light bulbs next week, because I think a good point to end on, and apologies to those who've heard this analogy before, but it is such a good one. Given that I'm just back from Dublin, there's an episode of Father Ted where he's very carefully explaining to Dougal the following. I'll just let Ted speak for himself.
These are small, but the ones out there are far away. Small, far away.
Now, in astronomy, that's actually pretty hard. Because when you look at these were all the nebulae that had been observed by Hubble and by others. Without knowing how far away they are by having something like a Cepheid to tell you the relative distance, you've very little handle really on whether they're small things inside our galaxy or whole separate galaxies. So that was the key step that Hubble was able to make by identifying these sort of yardsticks, these Cepheids, as a way to give you the relative distances. And this was a great debate in the early 20th century. There were advocates all the way back to Herschel who argued that basically our Milky Way galaxy was all there was, and that these nebulae, which, you know, even Herschel had observed some of them, were just inside our galaxy. They were just gas clouds within inside our galaxy. And all the way up to the early 20th century, people like Harlow Shapley had argued in favour of our galaxy being basically the entire universe. But Hubble was able to settle that question. Although, back in 1920, before Hubble's work, in a way indicating that, you know, scientists will still have a good argument even if they've got no data whatsoever to support their competing theories, there had been a great debate, and Shapley argued successfully that the nebulae are within the Milky Way. So there were a few people arguing the other side. Weber Curtis was his opponent that day. But Shapley won the day. But then, just a few years later, Hubble comes along with data that would overturn all that. And that's what we'll pick up the story with next week. Hubble's observations of Andromeda and what that led on to. And the expansion of the universe and the redshift. Okay? See you next week.